march of time. On a thousand fronts, the history of the world moves swiftly forward. Each day, each hour, a new exciting act is being played on the world's great stage.
British machine guns hammer at strafing Japanese planes. British soldiers carry torch and gun against Arab ambuscades. British civilians lock in struggle with police on London streets. British diplomats step gingerly through the powder house of Europe.
Thus, troubles pile high for just one nation in this news-packed week. Throughout the world, other nations, other men respond in their own way to the unfolding plot of world events. And millions of American women and men have found that they can best follow this never-ending plot from week to week in the pages of Time, the weekly news magazine, and Life, the big all-picture magazine. Life, with its hundreds of pictures, will help you to see the world, to eyewitness great events. Time, with its terse, vivid story, will help you to understand the news and catch the full meaning of every significant act. And to make this tremendous drama still more real to you, the editors of Life tonight join the editors of Time in presenting by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week. From the March of Time. This week, the nation's eyes are on New York City and a merry-go-round election contest involving the future of a GOP progressive hope, the future of the American Labor Party, most up-and-coming U.S. third party hope for 1940, and the future of the nation's most famed municipal ring, Tammany Hall. On one side, short, stocky, fiery Jewish-Italian Mayor Fiorello H. LaGuardia.
Say, we not only have Tammany groggy, we've got them worried. When before have you seen Tammany cringing on the ropes? We've got Tammany licked.
Tall, athletic Tammany and New Deal back Jeremiah Titus Mahoney.
LaGuardia's lawless, rabble-rousing municipal menace number one.
So, with the third biggest elective office in the U.S. as prize, the biggest off-year election goes into its final week. And on the sidelines of the biggest U.S. political circus are many a great and near-great fan. Band leader Cab Calloway.
LaGuardia's never let the Negro race down. He considers the high and the low. Or I might say the high-de-high and the low-de-low.
LaGuardia running mate, district attorney candidate racket-smashing Thomas Dewey.
Tammany County Clerk Albert Marinelli is a political ally of thieves, pickpockets, thugs, dope peddlers, and big-shot racketeers.
Tammany Station Alfred Emanuel Smith.
I got nothing to say.
One-time Tammany Mayor James J. Walker.
I have nothing to say.
Baseball's King of SWAT, Babe Ruth.
Mayor LaGuardia has been in there hitting in the pinches. It would be silly to take him out now and send a sub in to bat for him.
Emporia, Kansas sage, William Allen White.
The Republicans need a man coming out of the back alleys, as Lincoln came out of the backwoods. That man is available. Fiorello LaGuardia.
New Deal boss James A. Farley.
George Mahoney's unswerving loyalty to the New Deal entitles him to the support of every Democrat in New York.
Syndicated columnist Walter O'Keefe.
Tammany has been acting like Gracie Allen with a campaign manager.
Says Gracie Allen.
I think I'd like to be mayor, but then, of course, Mr. LaGuardia is a nice man, and so is Mr. Mahoney, and I'd hate to keep either of them out of a job. Or would you?
But at week's end, computes betting commissioner Robert Green.
The odds on LaGuardia are 4.5 to 1. On Dewey, 2.5 to 1. With no Mahoney money in sight.
In 1786, Revolutionary War veterans founded a patriotic, social, and charitable organization called the Tammany Society of New York, named for Christianized Indian chief St. Tammany. For a century and a half, Tammany Hall survives the iniquities of the Tweed Ring, the famed Central Park graft, Samuel Seabury's expose of the Walker regime, its defeat by Fiorello LaGuardia. But this week of 1937, Tammany faces a gloomy future. For if the New Deal Mahoney wins, the wigwam must undergo its severest house cleaning in 150 years. If the odds-on favorite LaGuardia wins, political observers predict Tammany leaders might as well tear down Tammany Hall. 1937 marches on. It is the chaotic post-war year of 1919. In Hungary's newly proclaimed capital city, Budapest, behind the massive walls of Marko Prison, a small, stocky man in yellow coat, yellow spats, and yellow necktie pores over a mass of documents and correspondence littering the bare table in a poorly lighted cell. A guard halts at the cell door.
better, Coon?
Yes?
I have an order for your release.
Good.
Your release has come from a very high government source, Herr Pedekun.
Huh? You are curious, huh?
Well...
Am I right?
Well, naturally, I wondered.
You really should know. Yes. I'm being released so that I can take over the Hungarian government. To the proletarians of Hungary, a proclamation. The bourgeoisie have abdicated. All the means of production belong henceforward to the workers and peasants. Long live the dictatorship of the proletariat. Long live Soviet Hungary. Signed, Bela Kun.
Next day in the Premier's palace, in a vaulted chamber overlooking the Danube.
Here is the list of important prisoners, Comrade Kuhn.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Tell me, have the arrangements been made for public executions?
There are four gallows in the public square. But, Comrade, not all of these men...
That is for me to decide. Captain Lajos Romagny. Who is he?
He is a former officer in the White Army.
Execution. And Ernst Dashes. Execution.
But Comrade Kuhn, Dashes was very sympathetic to us during the formation of the Republic.
He cannot be trusted. Execution. Stefan Zapolius. Execution.
For 133 days, Bela Kun sits in his Danube palace, rules the world's second Soviet Republic in a reign of terror unique in revolutionary history, until his regime collapses before the advance of Czech and Romanian armies. But in Moscow, standing in the Kremlin a few months later, still spick and span in bright yellow clothes, still wearing an insolent smile, is Bela Kun, guest of Russia's great proletarian dictator Lenin, seeing for the first time mustachioed and little-known Bolshevik named Stalin.
Then, for the present, Comrade Kuhn, you will consider yourself an honored Soviet citizen.
For the present, Lenin.
And this is Stalin, Comrade Kuhn, one of our ablest young Bolsheviks.
Oh, yes. Tell me, when shall I meet Leon Trotsky?
You admire Trotsky, eh, Bela Kuhn?
Why not? Trotsky is one of the great figures of the World Revolution.
Of course. The World Revolution.
Uprisings in Greece, in India, civil disturbances in Vienna, revolution in Brazil, the march of civilian armies in leftist Spain. And wherever there is mass revolt, police and intelligence blame a man in a yellow suit who has just escaped their clutches. Rumored in fantastic places, sometimes in two places at once, Bela Kun becomes a legendary but always obscure character in the world's news. Then, suddenly, 3 months ago, the name of Bela Kun is heard no more. In this week of 1937, out of a cell in Moscow's grim Lubyanka prison, is led a little prisoner in a dirty yellow suit, a fortnight's growth of beard on his prison gray face.
This way.
Comrade... Is it my trial at last?
Yes.
Are they all there? All the high party members?
I do not know.
Is Comrade Stalin there?
I do not know.
In here?
In here. Comrades, the accused... Bela Kun.
through the door which has closed behind every old Bolshevik who clung to the idea of world revolution, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Bukharin, Radik, goes the one-time ruler of the world's second proletarian dictatorship. Whether to oblivion or to death, no man outside the Kremlin knows. But this week in the home of a Hungarian peasant, a mother tells a child an oft-repeated legend.
His skin was yellow, and his hair was yellow, and his teeth were yellow, and he fed on the flesh of newborn babes. He lived in a palace in Budapest, near the public square.
And was the Danube really red?
Oh, yes, red. Red with blood.
Is Bela Kun still alive, Mother?
He never dies, child.
But you said he was only in Hungary for 100 days.
Oh, he may come back unless we are very good and say our prayers. Bela Kun may come back.
Time marches on. In the village Dundalk, on the Bay Dundalk, in the Irish Free State, early one evening this week, a Scottish girl and an Irish boy saunter through a public park.
And if you soften not your eye, then life and I in pain must part.
Now I know what the word blarney means, Michael.
I sing my heart out to you and you call it blarney.
Aye.
Julie.
Oh, no, Michael. I can't let you.
One kiss, Julie. Nobody's looking.
Well, then. But then I make a practice of it.
Hey there, the two of you.
Oh, he saw us, Michael.
Officer, let me tell you, I...
You're under arrest, the both of you.
Officer, I...
I'm sorry, me lad, but you'll have to go before a magistrate.
Twenty minutes later in the district court of Dundalk.
Julia Clark.
Aye, Your Honor.
Residence.
Glasgow, Your Honor.
Julia Clark, you're accused of publicly kissing one Michael O'Rourke. Is that true?
Well, I was kissed by Michael O'Rourke.
Michael O'Rourke, did you not know such action was against the law?
I did, sir.
Michael, what's again the law?
Silence, please. Criminal Code Section 18 forbids any act offending modesty or causing scandal or impairing the morals of the community.
Impairing the morals? One kiss?
Michael O'Rourke, you're fined £2 for violation of the criminal code. You, Julia Clark, because you came down here from Scotland and violated the Irish law, I sentenced to 1 month in prison. Furthermore, you're barred from ever entering the Irish Free State again.
Passed by the De Valera government in 1935, this week Ireland's new vice law is legally interpreted as meaning that one public kiss has impaired the morals of the Irish community of Dundalk. And this week from behind prison bars, says indignant Scot Julia Clark.
They didn't have to worry that I'll ever impair the morals of this dour Irish country again. I was fully intended not to come back, not even for Michael O'Rourke.
1937, marches on.
Elixir sulfanilamide. Treatment for all conditions in which the hemolytic streptococci appear. Dose, begin with 2 to 3 teaspoonfuls in water every 4 hours. S. E. Massengill Company, manufacturing pharmacists.
One day this week in his office in Mount Olive, Mississippi, Dr. J. E. Calhoun is talking on the telephone as Nurse Evelyn Sharber signs for telegram.
Yes. Yes, Miss Byrne. Severe cramps. Nausea, them. Well, have you given him the medicine I prescribed? Yes, that's it. Elixir sulfanilamide.
This telegram is for you, Doctor.
Oh, just hold the line, Mrs. Byrne. Hello, Mrs. Byrne. Don't give John any more of that medicine, under any circumstances. I'll be right there.
What is it, Doctor?
Wire from the drug company. Something wrong with that medicine.
Well, Dr. Calhoun...
I haven't got time now. Here, breathe the wire.
If anyone calls, say I won't be back until late. I prescribed that stuff to 13 patients.
This week, out from the Massengill Drug Company, go 1,000 telegrams. Warnings that 375 shipments of yellow-labeled bottles sent from Bristol, Tennessee, across the U.S. 6 weeks ago may contain a fatal poison. And this week, Dr. Archie Calhoun drives all night through Covington County, Mississippi, finds many a patient already suffering from the sharp cramps of poisoning, finds at some homes he has arrived too late. And at last, his circuit completed at dawn, tired and haggard, Dr. Calhoun returns to his office, finds the lights still burning.
Nurse. Shaba.
I fell asleep waiting.
Did you see that wire from the Massengill Company?
Yes.
I can't understand. I've come from John Bird's, my best friend. He's dead. And Mrs. Penn, Ed Sullivan, young Calder.
What are the symptoms?
Nausea, cramps. Get worse and worse, and then... liver and kidneys are completely destroyed.
Dr. Johnson tells me there's no antidote.
You talked to him?
Well, I couldn't get hold of you. You see, I've had a little sore throat for the past 5 days. I've taken 4 doses of it myself.
This week, wondering when the cramps of acute poisoning will seize her, Nurse Evelyn Shabra works with Mississippi Dr. Calhoun to save the lives of others not so severely poisoned. At week's end, throughout the U.S., 55 men, women, and children who have taken elixir sulfanilamide are dead. Scores more not yet out of danger. Says editor of the Journal of American Medicine, Dr. Morris Fishbein,
nothing like the present situation has risen in American medicine in many years. Sulfanilamide has performed miracles in the treatment of streptococci infections. The Massengill Company dissolved the drug in diethylene glycol, which is about the same as an antifreeze solution used in automobiles. Our experiments indicate the diethylene glycol in the elixir is causing the deaths.
Comments manufacturer of elixir sulfanilamide, compounder of veterinary medicines, Dr. S.E. Massengill.
My chemists and I deeply regret the fatal results of the elixir, but there was no error in the manufacture of the product. I do not feel that there was any responsibility on our part.
Time marches on. Stuttgart, Germany. One day this week, returning from a factory inspection in the German province of Wittenberg, Edward Duke of Windsor makes an unscheduled stop at the one-time palace of King Otto. He's met at the door by flustered provincial governor Wilhelm Moore.
I had a sudden notion I'd like to drop in here. You don't mind, do you?
Well, your Royal Highness...
You see, I visited old King Otto here in this castle before the... That is 1913.
Well, Stuttgart Castle is all changed now. It is a sort of exposition, a colonial demand exposition.
I see. These pictures on this wall, what are they?
The pictures, yes. They prove the untruth of assertions Germany mismanaged her colonies before the war. I hope your Royal Highness understands.
Oh, yes. There, it says, British falsehoods. And what are the neon lights on the other wall?
The smallest, the very smallest ring shows poor Germany quite stripped of colonies and raw materials, Your Highness. The larger ring shows the unjustly swollen French Empire. And the largest ring, Your Royal Highness, after all...
The British Empire, of course. But what is the very small white object?
That shows the comparative size of the British Isles.
Then, Herr Governor, the purpose of this exhibit is...
Well, naturally, Your Royal Highness, Germany hopes someday to get her colonies back.
With the curious diplomatic blunder of Britain's one-time king, has recalled a one-time dictum of intuitive Adolf Hitler.
If it had been possible last December for me to talk to King Edward VIII for just 1 hour, the abdication of his majesty could have been avoided. he had a responsibility not only to Britain, but to Europe, of which he did not seem to be aware. His abdication was a serious blow to German interests.
This week, as the rumor spreads that Edward of Windsor and his Duchess are Adolf Hitler's candidates for puppet emperor and empress of a united Germany and Austria, a more credible and disturbing surmise, persisting in spite of a public denial by Britain's former king, is aired in Europe's diplomatic circles. That Edward's trip to Germany's colonial demands exhibit was no accident, but a scheduled feature of his German tour. A gesture that has done more than any single news fact to strengthen the diplomatic hand of Adolf Hitler against the world's democracies and against the world's one great democratic monarchy, the British Empire. London. Drawn by eight gold-harnessed Windsor Greys, flanked by the Brigade of Royal Guards, escorted by the Household Cavalry and Yeomen of the Guard, one day this week up to Britain's Houses of Parliament rolls the gilded state coach. The occasion, the opening of Parliament. A few minutes later in the House of Lords, looking out over the peers of his realm, Britain's King Emperor sits immobile on the throne. Solomon well poised in the heavy crown his brother Edward never wore. George VI nods to his lord, who in turn nods to the Lord of the Black Rod, courier of the King's command to the House of Commons, traditionally hostile to the King's wishes. He sees the men of his faithful Commons jostle into the gallery in traditional disorder, sees peers and peeresses turn on cue to lift lorgnettes, glare in traditional disapproval. Then, kneeling before the throne, the Lord Chancellor hands to the King the speech opening his first Parliament.
May it please your Majesty to accept this speech from the throne, prepared in your service by your faithful ministers of state, and to read it forthwith in the graciousness of your sovereignty.
I accept it, my lord. Arise. My lords, members of the House of Commons, my relations with the foreign powers continue to be friendly. My dominions, my colonies,
So this week, George VI reads the traditional peacetime prelude to the speech from the throne, a statement of the Empire's friendship toward the foreign powers. But not so traditional this week is a stormy session of that same Parliament. On the floor is Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, whether we like it or not, we must cooperate with Italy.
What about the Italian piracy in the Mediterranean? Does the Right Honourable Prime Minister deny that British ships are still being torpedoed by Italian submarines?
Mr. Speaker,
His Majesty's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Captain Anthony Eden.
The Spanish Non-Intervention Committee has made remarkable progress during the past week.
Non-Intervention Committee? It's a cat and mouse committee. And Mr. Eden is certainly not the cat. The cat, gentlemen, is Mussolini.
Order! Our policy, necessarily, is closely related to the condition of our armaments. Until our rearmament program is completed and the strength of our armaments is unchallenged, Britain cannot proceed except cautiously.
Mr. Speaker.
The member for Kilfissel, Mr. Clement Attlee.
Speaking for the Labour Party, as that party's leader on the floor of this House, let me say that we know, and Mr. Eden knows, that this week has only been another week of abject grovelling by Britain. Grovelling before Mussolini, before Hitler, before the Japanese military. Last week, the Prime Minister called America the most powerful nation in the world. Perhaps that's true. Certainly we all know that Britain is no longer a first-class power.
This This week, with confirmation of another submarine attack on a British ship in the Mediterranean, with the killing of a British soldier in Shanghai by a machine-gunning Japanese plane, with British men and munitions pouring into China on a wartime basis to protect the Empire's huge interests in the Far East, with Mussolini officially endorsing and Edward of Windsor tacitly approving Germany's desire to regain her lost colonies at the expense of Britain's empire, disturbing are the omens which attend the opening of George VI's first parliament. But calmly in character as the symbol of the empire's unity, Britain's King Emperor pronounces the benediction, concluding his speech from the throne.
I pray under the blessings of Almighty God that the outcome of the deliberations of my parliament may advance the happiness and well-being of my people and the peace of the world.
Taking the arm of his queen as they enter the stagecoach, George VI catches a glimpse of his elder daughter, Lilibet, being hustled into a car ahead, knowing what the world learns for the first time this week, that by doctor's orders, his queen should bear no more children, that unless a male heir is born, Elizabeth will one day be Britain's sovereign. And this week, returning to Buckingham Palace between respectful rows of subjects, singing the time-honored words, God save the king, make him victorious, happy and glorious, Britain's monarch ponders less, perhaps, on the humiliations of Britain's empire in the reign of George VI than on what the future holds in store for his realm and for his house in the reign of Elizabeth II. Time marches on. On through another eventful week of the fascinating Stranger Than Fiction news pageant, which millions of American families now follow from week to week in the pages of Time, the weekly news magazine.
If you are stirred by the devastation of teeming Shanghai, interested in the strategic retreat of China's battered army, in the impending economic crisis in Japan,
read Time tomorrow. Time makes the news from Asia vivid and clear and understandable.
If you are interested in Mussolini's diplomatic wedge to cut off Russia from France and England, in France's dread of a fascist revolt in North Africa, in Adolf Hitler's triumph to the north in Danzig,
read Time, out tomorrow. Time makes the news make sense.
If you are interested in the weeks up and down and up of the stock market, in the peace overtures of the AFL and the CIO, in the political future of the Republican Party,
read Time tomorrow. It fits together the vast, scattered jigsaw puzzle of American news.
If you are interested in new books, new plays, new pictures, in what is being invented, voted, written, painted, in what is happening in business, in what is being discovered in medicine and science,
read Time. It will make you well-informed and keep you well-informed.
The new issue of Time, the weekly news magazine, will be on the newsstands tomorrow with all the news of all the world, told so concisely that you can read it in a single evening, so clearly and vividly that you can't forget it, and so entertainingly that it's always fun to follow the news in Time.
Time marches on.
Again, next Thursday night at the same time, the March of Time. This is the National Broadcasting Company.